Hi, John.
Hey, Alex.
You know what I hate? Movies that use time travel to solve problems within the plotting because the author was too lazy to write better. Which, of course, we're referencing The Prisoner of Azkaban, the movie that was directed by Alfonso Cuarón, who also directed Children of Men. Look, if you got a better opening, I'd love to hear it. I can't think of shit.
No, I'm just happy we got the Harry Potter thing out of the way.
I don't even remember if that's the movie with time travel in it, to be honest.
That it is.
Okay.
It's so dumb because it leaves the third. They're just, never mind. Yeah, it's magic. It doesn't matter.
No, I mean, it does because the rest of those books actually do make logical sense. But that one, I think, maybe she was just like, holy shit, I'm rich. I don't really have to try anymore. But yeah, the boy, that... Could have put magical time travel. Oh, how about the next book where someone major dies? Yeah, all the magical time travels, they're all broken.
Yeah.
That's literally how they explain it away. They're all broken.
Oh, that's great.
It's really stupid. Children of Hogwarts.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so Children of Men. This is your first time seeing it.
Yes.
Yes. What'd you think?
Yeah, no, it was great. It feels very much a movie of this time, despite it being made in 2006.
Yeah, it feels pretty damn current. It's also technology shown. They really did a good job of predicting what technology would look like. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's supposed to be 7 years in our future. Or it's 2027, I think it's taking place in. But they've got like a flat screen TV at one scene, and it really looks like what they ended up having, 14 years later. There was a lot of like, damn, this movie, because they didn't try to make it all flashy and great the way the technology kind of moved forward. And it was pretty impressive.
Yeah. Which I do like that, despite it being 2027 and it being the infertility having happened in this world for like about 18 years at this point, that, we still better make and sell more crap.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it seems like technology is still ongoing and it's not like they've reached a thing and then they stopped. Although basically at the same time, the world is moved on. Like it's crumbling. But then you see ads in the back for like sweaters for your dogs.
Oh, I didn't notice that one. That's great.
Yeah. There is so much stuff in the background of this movie. And I think it's good that it's just in the background because it really helps. The locations for this are so just fertile and making this world.
Yeah, but not in women, right?
Not in women.
Fucking broads ruining the planet.
Yeah. They don't tell you why in the movie that the women are infertile. But we all know it's just laziness.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was God's vengeance. After that whole apple thing.
Yeah.
What I really like about this movie, and it relates to the kind of background stuff you're referencing there, is how much work it does without being exposition dumps.
Yes.
So one of the small ones is like at one point, it doesn't matter when it happens in the movie, but they reference what happened in New York and they don't say what happened, but it's assumed New York's not there anymore.
Right.
And it's so small, but that really fills in a lot of the storyline of what happened off screen.
Yeah. And there's a lot of it is also just relegated to like TV stuff.
Yeah.
Or like stuff on the background, but at the same time, in this way that isn't just in local news, here's the plot. Like I had the misfortune of rewatching Equilibrium recently. And, in so much of that, the giant Big Brother talking head is just explaining the concept of the movie to the people in the movie the whole time. But well, this is more just like the use of Baby Diego.
That was perfect.
I loved. Because it puts in the place that like, oh, he was this celebrity for being the youngest person alive. There's no one left. So that's, oh my God, there's no more young people, but also just what an awful dick he is.
Yeah.
Made me very happy.
I love that as a plot point. Cause that's such good writing I would never have thought of that. Like I write stuff. I'm pretty good at it. A little bit. I mean, I'm no Warhammer 40K fiction writer, but I can turn a phrase, but I never would have thought about that as, of course, there would be the youngest person celebrity. It's such a smart move.
Yeah. And he just looks like one of those like YouTube jackasses, which is kind of funny.
Yes. He very much reminded me of certain YouTube jackasses that I will not name.
He got stabbed because he spit on a fan.
Yeah. Oh, so good. What a great backstory. And it all happens. I mean, we're watching it on TV. We're watching it on TV as our lead character is getting a coffee and like living his life. And we're walking through shitty London. So it's not only you're getting the backstory of baby Diego, but you're also seeing, well, this is what London looks like. You get the posters of, you know, all immigrants are illegal, kick them out of our country kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of world building without slamming you over there. Just it's subtle world building and it gives you just enough to enjoy the story, which, you know, we watch a lot of movies where just that's not the way they do it. So it's so nice to just have a subtle hand. It's like, oh, subtlety, how I've missed you.
Yeah. Well, and I think also just that the stylistically, the way he shoots this movie, like a lot of handheld stuff. And this was very well known at the time it came out for having these very impressive, super long takes. And there's two specific examples. The bit in the car, and then at the end of the refugee camp.
Yeah, the blood splatter scene. Yeah.
What I like about these so much is that because it's shot in this almost documentary style, and there's very little music in this entire movie, but it makes it seem kind of more real and immediate, without being flashy in that way. And so when these super long takes happen, kind of don't realize it until either in the midst of it or whatever. It's not showy in that. And we talked before about like this kind of started people wanting to do these very bravado like long takes to be like, look what I can do, look at how intricate and technical this is, which can be cool. I mean, that's why Orson Welles did it in Touch of Evil, but it works, so it just fits so nicely in this. It doesn't feel show-offy. It's there for a reason, not just to be like, hey, look what we can do.
That's why I watched this the first time. So when this came out, I was just out of college. So I was still kind of in my watching pretentious movie phase. I had heard about this really long shot. I'd heard about the car chase long shot. And it sounded great. That was the reason I watched this. And I was like, holy fuck, this movie. But it was one of those things where I watched the movie and went, oh, I forgot to pay attention to that long shot. Because it was just the way they filmed that scene, and it looked great. Yeah. And it was afterwards, I was like, oh, shit. Yeah, that was you know, either one shot or, you know, really well-tricked multi-shots. And it's rare that movies pull that off, because usually it's like, oh, look at them hanging a hat on it. You know, like those movies where, what the fuck movie was it where the camera flips around? Oh, Avengers. Where Joss Whedon does that long tracking shot when they're arguing in the lab and the scepter is in there, and he goes into the lab. Everybody's going nuts, and the camera literally does like a front flip. Mm-hmm. And he's like, "Oh, dude, calm the fuck down!" Like, yeah. I get what you're doing. It's actually not that bad. That's not like the most egregious example, but that's what I could think of. It's like, but stop showing off. Or just film the fucking movie.
The last time we were talking about this, I brought up specifically. I don't remember if it was Skyfall or the last Daniel Craig James Bond movie that was garbage. Where like the whole opening is this very impressive single camera take, and it is neat. It's very impressive, but it is like, boy, you didn't need to do it this way at all. Like, it doesn't really add anything other than to show off what you can do, you know, but whatever. I like the way they do it in this.
Yeah. All right. So they open the movie with him getting some coffee, which is, you know, good. Coffee's good. And he walks out and an explosion happens right behind him. Very effective, because you're not expecting it. You don't know what kind of movie you're in. Like, oh, you know, pretty oh shit. Mm-hmm. But what I heard was that had happened in London, like right before this movie.
There was an attack in London of some bombings, like not too long before, and they had already like made a deal that they were going to do this, but the authorities said like, you have one day to do this. We can't have multiple days of you guys blowing stuff up.
Yeah, I'd ballsy them to go through with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those, could have been one of those Spider-Man World Trade Center situations.
Right.
You know, having to refill. I mean, although this movie looks great, I can't imagine it's got much of a budget.
No, in fact, I believe it didn't really make much money here in the U.S. It was like $70 million or something like that, I think. Almost made that much back. But it caused Cuaron to kind of like be like, screw American filmmaking, I'm going away for a while.
I mean, is this even an American production? I mean, you can only think of one American in the movie. Like, yeah, Julianne Moore is the only...
Well, I think the production company.
Oh, I just assumed it was English. Okay. Yeah, because they got all those dirty terrorist accents, you know, non-American accents.
You're right.
So he goes to his office and fakes sick. Well, he says, it turns out I'm more upset about the death of baby Diego than I thought. Can I work from home?
Yeah, because everyone at his office is watching the news about baby Diego. And I love that bit about how he's like, yeah, I was just almost blown up. It's more like I still have to go to work, you know.
Yeah.
Still just going to work. But he can't just, his excuse is not that he was almost blown up. It's that like he's making up that he feels bad about baby Diego when he does not care.
The whole world breaking down seems weird too. Well, not weird. I mean, I get that would happen, but it seems like it happened too quickly.
Well, I don't think it's just the infertility. I mean, there was the whole flu thing that started the infertility. They make reference to that.
Yeah.
So things were already ravaging, as we can see currently. That's going great. But then there's also been I believe there were some references to like some natural disasters and stuff like that.
Yeah, I guess
and
then that other
caused some upheaval other places. And
yeah, I mean,
there's even again another on his way from work. You see this screen on the subway or the train or whatever he's on, the bus, that has a screen that's playing like about how the rest of the world is terrible, but Britain soldiers on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess what I thought was, I thought, because they talk about, like, I think there's been a nuclear war. I think that's what happened in New York. What I was reading as it was causal from the infertility. But yeah, you're right. It's probably just, you know, coincident. Yeah. I wonder if coincidence a word.
I don't know. I just trusted you on that.
Yeah. Coincident? Coincident. Okay, who gives a shit? And we see the unrest as he's riding the train, which is nice of people that, you know, have nothing throwing shit at the train, which is delightful. What I like, I mean, there's a little out of order, but I love, so we see Britain as it is, you know, this scummy, you know, it's falling apart. I love that later spot of the film. I think it's when he's visiting his cousin, where they go through these like wrought iron gates and everything's like all like poshy Britain still. Everyone's riding horses with like big beef eater hats and everyone's like drinking tea in the park and looking at a zoo. It's fucking brilliant.
Well, that's particularly funny to me because this old job I used to have, I would do one of the gigs I would do is this company would take their top salespeople to some exotic location and they would have an award show and stuff there. And we would go and put on the award show and then film them at the award show and at other parts of their vacation. And then I would sit in a hotel room and edit for 4 days so they could see what, so they could get a vacation video on the last day, basically. And I was in London for one of them. And when I was in London there were some riots that were happening and I was staying in a fairly posh hotel because of that's where the event was. And so like everyone, when I get back, everyone's like, oh, did you see any fires and stuff? I'm like, no, nothing was wrong where I was.
Oh yeah.
And so it's the same kind of thing where it's just, yeah, the rest of the world is like, okay, you guys are screwed. We've got ours. So we're going to just lock you off, which was, yeah, I thought very, very effective because you're already seeing that. You're going to see more of that.
Yeah. It was one of the things because I fell for it so bad that it's like, oh, the whole world's like this. It's like, oh no, I forgot. Fucking rich white people get a rich white people. Like it's delightful. So he goes to visit Michael Caine, who, I mean, I can't tell if I love Michael Caine or I'm in love with Michael Caine, but he is so fucking fun in this.
He is a lot of fun in this. And like, I like that character both as, I think he's an affable, fun guy, but he's also a great grotesque caricature of that kind of like post 60s hippie kind of guy, even though I don't think, you know, like the age is probably not right for it, but also like the ineffectiveness of that kind of protester revolutionary guy.
Yeah.
Because like he's famous for making political cartoons, which you see a couple of and they're like dog shit. They're like, oh, what if they're shooting down storks?
Yeah.
You know, the kind of shit you see in your local newspaper. But then it's also that he, his wife apparently was like a photographer or something and she got beaten up by MI5, but that's covered up. Although the news story that he has up about it. To give you all this information, the camera just pans across this wall of photos and stuff like that. But and they didn't know this, but the photo that's supposed to be accompanying the news story about it, it looks like a meme. It's got that impact font.
Oh, and, I didn't even notice. You know, yeah.
Yeah. Well, because I spend too much time online. I'm just like, all right, where's the joke there? I don't get it.
Yeah.
But he lives in a pretty nice place, like in the middle of nowhere, and he's kind of checked out from the world. He got his, so that's fine. He's done fighting people. He comes around later, but that sort of initial introduction I liked.
Yeah.
Plus he's just affable as hell.
And I also like that he keeps his suicide pills on the counter. Mm-hmm. Oh, I mean, we didn't even talk about that. There's this running thread of quietus. I think it's both antidepressant and suicide pill. I think they make reference to.
Yeah.
So that the government just gives you, it's like, all right, either die or be pacified, which I think is great. I mean, this movie does call heavily on 1984 and some Clockwork Orange stuff and
that's kind of a very Soylent Green thing as well.
Yeah. So I love how flippant he is with that. It's great because that pays off later. We'll get to it, but like where you think he's dead for a second, it's a great in quotes gag. It's a
good gag. Yeah.
I love Michael Caine's house a lot. I love that he has a hidden driveway, kind of dream gig.
His house is hidden from the road. Like they put like down trees in front of it.
You know, on the way in, they show cows burning.
Yeah.
Which is a weird thing to do when people are starving. That was the other part I didn't really understand.
Well, there's still disease and stuff. I mean, there's just...
Oh, so you think it's like a mad cow kind of food supply issue?
Kinds of issues going on.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like just walk over and like bite a cow. I mean, they're right there.
Yes. Yep, that's just like God intended.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying I could take a cow in a fight, but, you know, I have the power of fire and spear.
I've always admired that about you.
Oh, thanks. I've been pretty proud of it myself.
Yeah.
I don't really... How do we get from hanging out with Michael Caine?
Because he's on vacation hanging out with Michael Caine, and then it was like spending the weekend there. And you get a little bit more like coloring of the world, and then he is going back to work on Monday, and he's kidnapped by a white dude with dreadlock.
Theo gets kidnapped by the Fishes, who are a pro-immigrant faction.
Right.
And as he's in a van, he meets Julianne Moore, who plays Julian, which I'm very thankful for because I know that actress's name, and therefore I can remember who she plays in the film.
Makes it sound like I paid attention to
it. Yes. I tried. It's just some of the names are just like Theo is such an awkward name for me to remember.
I'm just getting worse and worse at remembering names in general, so it's fine by me.
Yeah, and his name means like God of Lighthouses,
right?
Which I was annoyed to read that, but that's not the movie's fault. That's whoever wrote it. Julianne Moore gives him the big pitch of, "Look, I'll give you like $500 or $5,000, and all you got to do is talk to your cousin to get him some kind of travel paper, get the lady some travel papers, and we're gonna get her to" wherever they're going. They're basically saying
the coast. Like, yeah, you have to have travel papers to travel within England.
Yeah, that's it, to the coast. And like, all right, so here is your MacGuffin. Please continue forth.
Julianne is his ex. They've clearly had some kind of falling out. Please do this for us. And he agrees to it just because he wants the money. He doesn't care. He's apathetic as hell. But he agrees to it. And so, yeah, he goes to see his cousin in the aforementioned, gated area.
Oh, yeah, that's where he goes to, like, the posh-ass area. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's super nice, like, his cousin has, like, the statue of David that they rescued from a museum where, you know, gallery where it was being shown because it was being bombed out. And he just has all this artwork.
Yeah, he's got Pink Floyd's pig, that floating pig they had.
And it's all kind of, like, meaningless. Because it's just unmoored from anything. It's just now he's just a thing he knows to have that's good. It's not even that, like, I need to preserve this artwork. And then when he ends up like to have dinner in front of Gwinnica, which I only know from the critic because his dad drives through it. And like his wiener kid is playing some stupid video game or something, just completely detached from everything. And so finally he makes the ask under the pretense of like wanting to take a girl he loves to the coast or something, to see her sick brother. Then he asks his cousin, he's like, why do you have all this stuff? Like it doesn't, in 100 years, no one's going to know any of this. Like, it doesn't matter. We're going to dust. And the guy's like, oh, I just don't think about it. And I like that response because he doesn't have to, you know, like,
yeah.
And they don't spend a lot of time with it. That's it. That's the scene. But it's just this little like, yeah, I can pretend that this isn't going on because I'm fine.
Yeah. But, you know, he's going to find out, you know, soon because there's some babies coming about that. You go, crap. Now I'm the steward of all great art. Dude's got some.
He wasn't planning on that.
Yeah. But he's got some fucking heavy weight on his shoulders, you know, in about 6 years when he realizes, oh, shit, the world's going to keep going. Now I literally have fucking David in my apartment. Oh, what did I do with its dick? It fell off like 6 months ago.
Well, I also like how Clive Owen was like, my mom had one in the toilet. It had some smaller version that dispensed toothpaste or whatever he says. That it's just like, yeah, you have this thing and it's kind of meaningless that you have it. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. And I liked it how it had its leg knocked off. It was a nice little, you know, kind of scene setting.
But yeah, from that, he re-meets up with Julianne Moore. He's got a whole thing where the only papers he was able to get was joint transit papers, basically. So he has to go along too. And he's like, so, like, I don't want to do it, but give me some more money and I'll do it. He meets up with, what's his name?
Chiwetel Ejiofor?
Yes, Chiwetel Ejiofor, the one of the main fish dudes.
I think his name might be Luke. I just looked up how to pronounce Chiwetel Ejiofor because I always forget how to do it. And I like that actor enough that I'm like, all right, I'm gonna bother.
Yeah, no, it's worth doing. He's a a good actor, and I really like him in this because it's also just not a a character I've seen him play.
Chiwetel Ejiofor was in that movie I like.
12 Years a Slave?
No, that I like. Serenity.
Oh.
You know the Joss Whedon movie?
Yep.
So I know him from that. I know him from Doctor Strange. You know, all of his great movies.
Yeah, all those great movies he's been
in. He was in Maleficent, you know.
Sherlock Gnomes.
He was in the Lion King remake. But this 6 Years a Servant sounds great. Definitely check that out. What's that so good of one of your grown up movies?
It's an Adam Sandler thing.
Oh, I love that. Have you seen Hubie's Halloween?
Several times now.
Oh, it's so good.
It's so nice being able to just access Adam Sandler whenever I need to, which is a lot.
You know, that Hubie is funny because he's like, you think he's like a normal guy, but he's actually a little slow in the head. He says such funny things.
And he likes Halloween.
I'm assuming. What I know about that is I saw the poster for Hubie's Halloween, and I'm not even confident that that's the name of the movie.
I'd say, his name is like Hubie Halloween or something, or that's what they call him. Halloween.
Woo! They are on their way to the coast together. Mm-hmm. He's got all the papers. Everything's good. And they're having a delightful time in the car. They're playing a game where you shoot a ping pong ball from her mouth into his mouth, her being Julianne Moore and him being Clive Owen. And they have enough chemistry, given that, you know, they don't need to have that much for the movie.
Yeah, and like you find out in this interim that they... One of the reasons they split is that they had a child that died.
Oh, that's a good point. Yes. They had a child named Dylan that died.
Yeah. But they're so like that old spark is kind of there and is kind of reigniting. And this is one of the first scenes that we were talking about that is an entirely like all one take, all one shot in the car. It appears to be. It wasn't. It was actually shot like several times. They kind of had to piece different things together. But the way that this worked is that like there's the camera was basically operated by this thing on the roof of the car and the chairs in the car would like fold down so the actors could go horizontal so the camera can like pass over them. So think about how weird that's got to be to like try to be in the moment with this and then also like pop in and out, like pop them out of trouble, but you're trying to have genuine human emotions. But it works. Like it's a really impressive scene. And again, it's one of those that you don't know, that you don't kind of realize till halfway through, like, oh my God, this is all just one take.
Yeah, that was the one that I showed up for the first time back in whatever year this came out, 2006-ish.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really good. And then so they've got this flaming car comes down the hill and they're like, oh shit, the car's, you know, we're about to get swarmed. And it becomes kind of a chase sequence. Julianne Moore gets shot on the neck, which was very unexpected the first time I saw it. Like, I did not see that coming. That was, you know, and then I look back, I'm like, oh wait, no, she was just having a delightful, good time with the movie's lead. Of course she's going to die. Like, that's right. What am I, an idiot? But, you know, that's good filmmaking.
But it's unexpected, like particularly in 2006, you're like, oh, the named person in this movie. I know Julianne Moore. I don't know anyone else in this movie. She'll be around for a while. Nope.
So Michael Caine, never heard of him, huh?
Nope. Who's that? but you know what I mean? Like in general, like.
No, I know. I just thought it'd be funny to say that you didn't know who Michael Caine was. I found that amusing.
I've forgotten him, just to prove a point.
Weirdly, Michael Caine quickly becoming high on our list of actors we've covered on the show. Third movie with him in it, at least.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you do, you know, we've done a couple of Nolan movies and you're going to get Michael Caine.
Well,
which, yeah, he's in the new one, too.
Oh, is he?
Mm-hmm.
I hope he plays a butler. I only like him as a butler. So, yeah, Julianne Moore is killed. There's, you know, really good long shot, which this leads into the cops pulling them over and a really tense scene there where Luke pulls out a gun and just kills two cops, which... Good performance by him, because I think Chiwetel Ejiofor is great in this. But Clive Owen's good in this too, where he's so confused because he doesn't know what's happening yet. He doesn't know that there's a pregnant woman in the car. He has no idea the stakes. He thinks he's just sneaking an immigrant out, and his confused freaking out, like his ex-wife just died. He doesn't know what the fuck's happening. He plays it really quite well, which that's a lot to pull off, especially in a long scene, you know?
Well, it's also interesting because his whole character is, a lot of this movie is his being this kind of cynical, aloof guy into actually like doing something. But at the same time, it's not done in this kind of traditional Hollywood sense. Like he doesn't have this like, you know, groundbreaking moment of like, oh, this, and I'll do, you know, it's not very grandiose. It just kind of happens. And so I feel like some of his performance is a little bit at arm's length, which I think works. because he is confused, but he's also kind of, you know, like, I'm not even supposed to be here today, man. I think undergirds a lot of the early part of his performance.
Yeah, it's nice. I think a lot of this movie was, how do I put this? We watch a lot of movies where acting is in short supply. Mm-hmm. I mean, last week was Noah, which, I mean,
Russell Crowe was good.
Yeah, Russell Crowe was, I mean, no one was particularly bad other than the handsome guy, but it's not like there was acting going on. There was people that acted fine, like they did their job, but this is like actually good performances, and it's kind of refreshing and also weird because I'm not accustomed to it, so like I don't know what to say. I'm like, this is good. Like,
just waiting for a laser to get shot up in the air.
Yeah, exactly. Where does the blue laser show up? Where does a sass talking half dog come in and then resurrect the robot and everybody cries?
Like, every movie needs that. Like, yeah. In Godfather 2.
Yes. When Gordon Shumway shows up after Luca Brasi is shot. So they go to Tomasz and Emily's farm, and boy, do I love somebody named Tomasz. And this is the big reveal. So I don't know what the preview for this movie was, like if it was given away that we're protecting a pregnant woman or there's a baby involved in this post-baby world.
Yes. But, yeah. I mean, I feel like they told you a lot of
stuff. Oh, okay. If you didn't know going in, and I don't remember the first time I saw it, but like this is a good reveal because like you don't know she's pregnant.
Yeah.
And, you know, she takes off her shirt and he's like, whoa, whoa, what are you doing? Like, I'm not in the mood for sexy times. My ex-wife just got shot. I've got blood on me still. What the fuck's happening? And his reaction to seeing her pregnant belly was pretty damn good. And her performance, I have no idea what the actress's name, but she did a great job of like kind of the, I don't know. I didn't know what was happening. I was raised in a world where no one was going to have babies. No one bothered to teach me about, you know, what pregnancy is like.
Yeah. It's Claire Hope Asherty, if I'm saying that right. But what I like about her, and I think there's a criticism to be made of this movie. You could make this criticism of this, kind of like the fact that this person then essentially is a MacGuffin, because it is just about like getting her across the border, making sure the baby's safe, because she's an immigrant. Like that's part of the whole reason they can't go to the authorities, because it's an immigrant. They're not going to let an immigrant, you know, be the future of mankind.
Yeah, they make a good book at one point. I think it was Luke throws it away. He's like, are you kidding me? There's no way that an immigrant's going to be the face of the first baby. They're just going to, they'd kill her and throw some posh black lady on the TV. Like, yeah, fuck, that's brutal, but a good goddamn point. Yeah.
And you see it, but like, I think because also like this is mainly, this whole story is told through the eyes of Theo, or at least you're spending most time with Theo, is that you don't, she is kind of relegated to the sidelines because it is part of his journey, but it is, she's not like a fully fledged character maybe, but at the same time, I do think that she's great. I do think she does like take what could just be I'm a helpless woman, get me out of here. And not only just in the script where it's like the weird things, how she wants to name her baby Bazooka, but it's just, that feels natural. She doesn't make that feel like an insane thing to say. That seems like something that character would say.
Yeah. You
know? Like, and she's I'm just a young, dumb kid. Like,
she's got some good sass to her though. She fights back in the car. Like, she pushes a dude's gun and like knocks a door open, and she does do some scrapping, but she's got a great line of like, well, who's the father? He's like, there was no father. It was a virgin birth. Right. And she's like, yeah, just fuck with me. I don't know. I was just bagging some dudes.
It's not just like a two-hander. It's not him and her. You know what I mean? Like, so often she's just kind of, she's not a focal point of scenes. Just acting wise, I guess you would say, but still, she's great. And I really like her.
Yeah. I just like that they gave her some sass instead of her just being like, hey, look, there's the womb we're carrying around.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This movie could have turned, we were joking about it before, but this movie could have turned into pretty anti-woman sentiment, which I'm surprised they didn't hint at, because I could see that being like, so in the book, it's that men don't produce sperm anymore. That's what happened. And in this one, that the women are barren. I could see, because there's a great thing they do in this where there's like kind of new religions springing up. The repenters and the
I forget what they call the flagellator.
Yeah. So they've got these kind of like crazy sects happening, and it could have easily turned into like, well, that's the sect that believes that women are evil because their barrenness is, and they didn't do that, which is nice, because especially now in 2020, people wouldn't get that that's, you know, a condemnation of those people. They would think, hey, there's something we can rally behind.
Yeah. Oh, those, they have a point.
Yes. Let us put on red hats and say that women are evil.
That Joker's on to something.
Oh, here's a very important point that I need to get to. is I really wish I could say in it without sounding like an utter prat. Also, as an addendum, I wish I could say prat without sounding like a prat. But boy, in it sounds so cool when people say it, and I can't even pronounce it right.
I still hate when people say cheers for like thank you.
Well, John, where do you want to go when everybody knows your name?
I'd rather they didn't. But I just, yeah.
So you're not always glad they came?
Like, I don't know. You watch football, don't you?
I don't mind saying cheers.
I'm not saying it's a rational thing. I'm just saying it bugs me.
I got you. I think there's a way to do it without sounding like an utter shithead.
Yes, yes.
Because I think it's like when people like hang a hat on it. It's like the same. It's like fedora wearers that say like m'lady. Mm-hmm. It's that same kind of shit.
I think because it kind of started with that, and now it's like a more normalized thing. But I don't know. I can't forgive them.
Yeah. So I wish I could say in it. And here's another thing that happens in this movie that you're going to explain to me right now. Why do they make a point of animals really liking him?
He's a likable guy.
It's weird because they spent a good amount of time. They've got those two dogs that don't like anybody liking him, that one cat, the cat at his place, and then that other cat that like hangs on his leg. And I think there's another one later. It's just weird.
Yeah. I don't know if that's an attempt to, you know, because as I said, like he's kind of aloof and at arm's length. That it helps show like, oh no, he's a good guy. Please be on this dude's side. I know he's kind of grumbly and whatever. He's not your typical sort of action hero, but we're not giving you a lot to go on with him. But look, he likes dogs and dogs like him.
I just thought his asshole smelled like cat food.
Could be that too. Yeah. they cut out all the scenes where he jammed cat food in his butt.
Yeah. My choice between it was either his ass smells like cat food or his balls smelled like catnip. And I wasn't sure what to do there.
You took the road less traveled, and it made all the difference.
Hey, did you know Star Anise acts like catnip to dogs?
I did not know that.
Yeah, I just found this out the other day.
Who's Star Anise?
Hey, just bend over in a mirror and look. You're Star Anise. In the night, the biker gang, the very biker gang that killed Julianne Moore, show up. One's really fucked up from getting knocked off his motorcycle. Hey, wait a second. Where did we see that earlier? Turns out it was a setup.
Mm-hmm.
The fishes set her death up for reasons. I didn't quite follow this.
Like it seemed like this was kind of like super secret fish meeting. Like they were electing a new leader and all this stuff. So I think it was sort of an intergroup struggle.
Oh, okay.
And they were, you know.
Oh, so you're saying this was like, this was a coup. This was a way to take over the fishes.
Yeah.
See, that seems weird because they endangered the life of the pregnant lady.
Yeah, but that's the only thing I can determine because even at the end Luke, you know, towards the end Luke makes something about like Julian not wanting it to be violent, but he seemed to be much more like, yeah, no, this has got to be violent.
I mean it makes sense. It's just the like shooting bullets near the only pregnant person in the world just seemed ill-advised. Well,
particularly when then in the subsequent action scene when they make it a point to not do that. But it did, yeah, it did like sort of a pullback to reveal that what it first seemed like just kind of like a random shot was an actual assassination.
Yes. And Charlie Hunnam's cousin was killed and he is very upset about it.
That's his cousin.
We start this revenge narrative of, oh no, his cousin's dead. His cousin, Marvin White Dreadlocks. So, Key and Peel and I can't remember anybody's name. Oh, Key and Theo and Midwife. Miriam. I got two out of the three.
Miriam, what's her name? I believe is her name.
What is that?
Who also has dreadlocks. Miriam.
Miriam. Okay. Yeah, but she's a midwife. I think you can get kicked out of midwifery school if you don't have dreadlocks.
But yeah, so he's like, hey, they're going to kill us. They just want to get your baby. Which is interesting because like they had a whole meeting before about what to do. And Clive Owen was like, get her some proper care. And they're like, you idiot. No, they'll just use her as a political tool, which is exactly what they want to do, but they don't want to admit it.
Well, they don't want to use this political tool for the other side.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they initially make it sound like just that she's a human being.
Yeah.
And, you know, she shouldn't be used as a political tool unless we do it. You know, the end of that sentence comes later. But so he overhears them kind of admit that if they find that they killed Julian and they're going to take care of Theo here in a moment. But so Theo gets Key and Miriam and leaves. And this was like the first there's this kind of ongoing joke of him having like terrible footwear.
Yes.
Because he's just like in his socks and he has to step out into the mud. And then later, like he's just in flip flops.
Yeah. And then
eventually a guy gives him shoes.
But... The one guy realizes it and shoots all the glass in the room and he has to walk over the glass before he goes into the ductwork.
Right. Yeah. And man, what a Christmas.
Yeah. Oh, I'm thinking of Children of Nakatomi Plaza.
Mm-hmm. I would like that very much if that line was in that movie, though.
Well, like,
what a Christmas.
You know what, edit. All right. So, yeah, they go to they sneak out after having a time of starting the car. They had to push start it. It's a tension filled scene.
Yeah. Again, another great example of where this kind of handheld, no music, long take stuff really pays off. I think it really helps. You're right there with them kind of sneaking along, and it really raised the tension a lot.
Yeah. And it also made me think, boy, I don't know enough about cars. Cause I'm like, is that even a thing? Like I seem to remember 1950s movies being like, oh, you could push start something. Or like, I don't even, and I know Carrie Fisher makes that joke with the Millennium Falcon in one scene, but how does that start a car? I don't even understand.
It juices up, you get enough juice in the alternator. Right. Because it creates the friction, which makes the electrical power to kinetically start things. And then you go, come on, baby. And then it starts.
I mean, a lot of those words seemed like words that made sense, like alternator. Yeah,
they all did.
I still don't get it.
Yeah. Well, not a car guy like me. I'm click and clack.
I couldn't remember their names. I was literally gonna say Chuck and Fock.
I'm clicking the streets, clacking the sheets. Maybe.
Ooh. So they get away after push starting their alternator confibulator, and mm-hmm. he's like, I know where to go. Let's go to my friend Michael Caine's house.
Yeah. No one will know that we're there. Who knows Michael Caine? Nobody.
Yes. See? And there is a delightful, another eavesdropping scene that happens, which a lot of dropping of eaves in this movie, where Michael mm-hmm. Caine is giving a speech about faith and chance, which I think is a nice little bit of acting, where it's his own kind of hippie philosophy, which is just horseshit, but it's fun to listen to. And him talking about faith and chance, he's like, well, they had faith to meet each other, that being Theo and Julian. He's like, well, then chance brought Dylan, their son, into their life. And then it was chance that in 2008 he died in the flu epidemic. And then it's faith, and he just does this whole thing. And it's a nice little bit of the kind of character building and good acting. And it's so nice. And no one had a bat suit on.
It just this whole movie very much felt anchored in the world around it. And it just little things like that. I don't know what it is about it, but it really just kind of helped make it seem like a lived in place.
Yeah. Boy, we're going to really have to watch some really garbage movie next week, because this is too easy for us. Like, this is nice and we watched a pleasant movie. Like, we're going to have to watch like a Neil Breen Suburban Sasquatch back to back.
Oh, boy. We have to.
No, we could do. We should watch that 5-hour Neil Breen How to Make Movies documentary you put out.
God,
we'll just show up and be like, oh, John, you know what I hate? Fucking the fact that my gun didn't go off when I put it in my mouth before. So, yeah, they're there. He gives this great faith and chance speech, which I really liked. And he said, basically, hey, we're going to what you have to do is you have to meet my friend Sid. I've been selling him drugs. He's like a border agent, and he's going to be able to sneak out. And then they're like, hey, that's a good plan. Oh, no, here, the bad guys found us, which I'm not sure how they found them.
I'm not entirely clear on that. I mean, they made some reference before, to like, we're watching you. We've got eyes on you. We know all about you. So it may be something that they knew already through their previous surveillance of him, you know, or something that because they knew Julian was a part of it. You know, she has some connection with them.
Oh, yeah. I forgot Julian did. That's probably because they said
it's at the moment. It seems a little bit convenient.
Well, they said you were here last week. He was here last week or whatever.
All right. Yeah.
So, I forgot they did threaten surveillance. So maybe it was just. But anyway, who cares? It was a convenient thing that happened.
Yeah.
And there you come, kind of raid the place, and our heroes hide up in the woods.
Yeah, and with Miriam and Key. And at this particular moment, they've already done this, but when he arrives back at Jasper's, it seems that Jasper and his invalid wife have killed themselves, because there's a box of quietus on the floor. But so it's a sad moment, but then you realize that Michael Caine was just sleeping, and he uses the quietus, mixes it with bread and gives it to the rats to kill them.
Yeah, it's a nice moment.
Yeah, it's a nice moment, but also, and then it ties in. He also tells a story about Clive Owens Or no, this was Julian in the car earlier. Julian Moore is telling a story about Clive Owen's old activism days. And at one point when the cops were coming to kick them out of their squat, he invited them up to talk about it and gave them some coffee. And the coffee was laced with ketamine. And so then that comes back around because Michael Caine kicks them out and gives quietus to his when the bad guys show up, kicks out the good guys, gives quietus to his wife and dog, apparently, and then invites some of those guys in for bread and coffee. And it's never, nothing comes of it, but I just like that implication.
Oh, no, it's fine. Yeah.
To drug them again. But then he dies heroically, asking for his finger to get pulled.
Yeah. Brutal scene, though. Yeah. I thought you'd like that. That seems like your hero. But getting your hand shot and then he shoots him in the knee, too. Oh, yeah. It was nice.
So, yeah. So they escape again. They're still trying to figure out what to do. They end up, I don't know why they end up back at the school.
That's, I think, where they're supposed to meet Sid, his contact.
Yeah. So you have this moment in the school and you get like, Miriam tells a story about how they started to figure out that kids weren't around anymore. And again, it's like, it's really depressing because it is like it's a primary school, an elementary school. And so there's all these kids drawings still up.
Yeah.
It's all, you know, abandoned like that.
And Miriam, she's, you know, because she's a midwife, she was telling a story about like how, you know, I had X number of miscarriages in a week, and then I called my friend in Sydney, and I called my friend in DC, and he was saying how his pizza shop was struggling. Because that's the thing they don't talk about. I can't believe I'm about to say this. In the world of Children of Men, is how people like Epstein are getting along. Because, you know, you worry about the future of mankind, but you know what people don't think about is what's going to happen to the pederasts. They need love too.
You know, this is just the episode now. It's just that phrase, and then that's it.
You have no idea how pleased I am for talking about a really heartfelt moment and then pivoting to Comet fucking ping pong pizza.
Yeah. What about Comet ping pong pizza? Why do you hate businesses? Why do you hate American ingenuity?
Exactly. So yeah, they meet Sid. Sid refers to himself in the third person, like every mentally healthy person.
That actor, Peter Mullen.
Yeah.
If you ever get the Last Action Hero's golden ticket and hop into a movie and you run into that guy, do not trust him.
Oh, yeah.
He is so good at playing evil, but like smiling evil. And even in this, like his, it's not even like a twist. Like he's a piece of shit from almost the get-go. And like their whole plan is to basically break into a refugee camp. And then someone from there will get them a boat. And they're going to hook up with this fabled human project that apparently has been secretly trying to save the world and figure out this humanity thing. So they use Sid to try to like break into this thing. And he's got this great Scottish brogue. But when he drops them off, he's like, okay, put on your refugee face. You know, sad. Got to be sad. And he just does it in this way, like he's completely just immune to any of the human suffering that's going on.
Oh, yeah.
Like he is, and he's, I'm sure, doled out of plenty of that suffering. But it's a very, as with so much of this movie, understated, just a piece of shit performance. Like he's such an awful, awful human.
Yeah.
But Peter Mullen does a great job.
No, he's terrific in it. And the one thing that, and I think they kind of walk the line fine, but there was a little bit of the kind of, you know, what do you refer to it? It's like the foreign savior kind of thing. We're like, oh, no, look, the nice foreign people will help us. You know, kind of the banality of, the British, of course, are this way. But indiscriminate foreign lady is going to take us in and risk her life. I mean, it was fine, but it kind of walked that line a little bit of that kind of that trope.
Sure. The helper woman, whose name I'm forgetting, she's coded very Romani.
I don't think they give her a name, does she? Do they?
No, they totally have a name. It's like, it's not Mackenzie.
Oh, you're right. It's America or something. It's a name that sounds like America.
Marika.
Yeah, I was right there. Yeah, that America saves the day. I gotcha.
Yeah.
A Marika saving England from a horror? Yeah, that sounds pretty fucking familiar.
The whole undercurrent of immigration, like the fears of immigration, that kind of thing, again, is something that feels very prescient now. And when they get taken to this immigration camp and Miriam gets like pulled off, they put a black hood on her head and you don't know what's going to happen to her, but it's not going to be good. But it really, I like the sort of underline, and I think this is a great job of it, of like, for lack of a better term, like infertility of spirit almost, or something like that. Like, it's not like, well, we're all doomed, so let's just make the best of it, everyone. It's like, well, no, we're still going to like see who's the worst people and treat them like our humanity is fully dead at this point.
Yeah.
And we're just going to treat these people like absolute animals and garbage.
Well, you know,
there's no hope. So fuck it.
die as he lived. Yeah, it's interesting too. This movie's pre-Brexit, so there's like a whole nother layer of shit going on.
Yeah.
And
oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and I think for us, we have our own thing, but yeah, if you are actually British, there's a lot more, I think, sort of resonant stuff.
Oh yeah, right now there's one guy in the nuclear waste outside of what used to be Atlanta, fucking a Dodge truck. On, we're gonna make America great again.
Yeah, we're gonna do it. This is I think maybe the only post like dystopian British future that doesn't involve dragons, which I applaud for that.
Or no, well, unless you're counting Fast Zombies, 28 Days Later, kind of post-apocalyptic London, no yeah. dragons.
You could see like a skeleton of one in the background of a scene.
Oh yeah, that's right. I was wondering why that one guy was eating ash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Certainly there was a lot of people in that movie that sucked ash.
All right, so basically they're in the Bexhill refugee camp, and it is awful. And on the bus in, there's a very fraught, tension-filled scene where Key starts giving birth, or water breaks.
Right, yeah, whole thing.
I know it's pretty tropey to have your water break in an awkward situation, to build dramatic tension, but I think it's kind of earned that the whole movie is about her being pregnant. I think it's kind of all right, but... You know, I'd be reticent to not point out that's a little, that could be on a TGIF show, but generally TGIF shows don't have Urkel going into an internment camp,
Right.
Yeah. Did I Arbod mock for I?
The later seasons of Family Matters got a little weird.
So. Yeah. They go into there and Merrick sneaks her into a shitty room. It's a great room for, what they're dealing with. It's a private room. It's got a bed. And she gives birth. And it's a living baby girl, which is pretty important because that's the first one in 18 years, as far as we know. Yeah.
And I thought that the actual birth scene was like, Clive Owen was remarkably like caring and nice in it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like he's kind of, like his heart's in a good place with this whole thing. But this is the first time like he was really like sweet.
Yeah. It's nice. He slow plays it. Kind of his growing attachment to Key and, the kind of friendship in a storm sort of thing. Also, did they show what happened to the midwife? I mean, other than they put a bag on her head, that was it. That's just the last saw of her.
Well, there's that row of people next to her, like down on their knees with their hands on their head. But that's it.
That's great. I kind of thought I missed something, but like, that's great that's because that's the way it would happen. It's just, it's gone. Never going to see that person again. Yeah. And so they have the kid, and this is, I think the end of this movie from this point on is so fucking good. There's like the action, the pacing, there's just so many like great kind of, I adore the end of this film.
Yeah. And it's like for being a big, long protracted action scene, it is not slick. It's not John Wick or anything, it's very brutal and real and rugged. And so eventually like when they get up the next day, Sid has shown back up and it's like, all right, I'm going to take you to this place, get you to this person, meet a boat, all this stuff. And then he realizes that she has a baby and he starts putting together like, I know that you guys have, you guys are wanted on the news for being cop killers. And I know the fishes want you guys. So I think, I can sell you out, make some money. They're able to escape from Sid. And this is like when the big long tracking shot starts, as they're trying to move through because there's been a bombing in the facility in the refugee camp, and the fish is back.
Bexhill refugee camp.
Yeah,
I wrote it down because I wanted to figure out what that meant. I thought maybe that was like a reference in England.
No, I think it's just a place.
Yeah.
Apparently the fishes have gotten in and they're like doing the uprising there, and the army's going to bomb the hell out of the place. So they got to get out of there. So they're just crawling through this rubble as this war is happening around them. And one of my favorite little moments in this is at one point he, while dodging some bullets, like throws himself behind an embankment and there's like a family there and they're all, he like lands on them. They're like, "What? Get out of here. Get out of here." And he's like, sorry. But just that little, comedy of errors in the midst of this firefight.
He's trying to chase down because Key has been taken at this point.
Yeah.
And there's a really great moment where he kind of catches up with them because he hears the baby crying. And he has like this heart to heart with Luke as Luke's at the window, like shooting fucking bazookas at, missiles at the tanks outside, mm-hmm. of like Luke kind of being sweet. He's like, I saw it for the first time. I forgot how beautiful's babies were. And then like going out, then leaning outside the window and shooting people. It's a really cool scene.
Yeah. And how Chiwetel how he does that like back and forth between like genuinely like this baby is the future and I'm just awestruck by this baby to like, you sons of bitches. He's not like a villain in the sense of like what he wants is ultimately good, right? Like he does want, you know, the refugees to be treated like human beings and all this stuff. They were going to try to, you know, overthrow the government that got them this way. But like, he's just going about it in potentially a terrible way. And I like that. I like that there's not really like the real villains you never actually meet in this. And I kind of like that.
Yeah. I mean, I correct. I don't know who the real villains would be, but I mean,
you know what I mean? Like their goals are decent.
No, totally. Yeah. They're just going about it kind of the weird way. And this leads into what I think is the best scene in the film, where it's Theo and Key and the baby walking down the hallway and like everybody kind of realizing that there's a baby there, and just like both sides of the fight stop firing. Everybody's just like stunned in this kind of almost like religious, like awe or ecstasy at this thing. And it was just, I honestly kind of like a little welled up. I'm like, this is amazing. Like everybody just freaking the fuck out of a baby. It was so good.
It was a very powerful moment that is broken by someone in the window shooting. And then they all just go back to it and forget about it.
Yeah.
Like it's in it. Cause like, I was thinking about that, like about how, you know, like no one like shepherded her away, you know, it's like, oh my God, there's a baby. We got to, you know, they're shooting. We got to protect the baby. They're no, just like, just back into it. This is amazing thing they saw, but like, we're just going to let this go.
Yeah. That was a very powerful scene. And then it leads to, so there's a lot of kind of religious metaphor in this and layers of meaning and whatnot. And I'm not going to say I caught all of it, but the one part that I missed completely. So he's back with Key and the baby, and they finally get to the boat area, and they go through like the little like kind of entry area with like, you know, overhanging concrete, and there's all like graffiti, but the graffiti is obviously cave painting related. Like they've got the hand covered in ochre. There's like the kind of stick people kind of, I don't remember what culture used those, but like it's obviously references to cave painting. Mm-hmm. And then them leaving that cave painting, and like, I think that's like a metaphor for something. Maybe I'm not just smart enough to get it, but I was like, that seems like a really heavy-handed metaphor that I'm not understanding. It felt kind of stupid.
A new beginning for mankind.
I mean, I guess it's that. I just felt like there's probably more to it, and I just don't understand it.
Yeah, I honestly forgot that bit happened. But yeah, that's my guess.
I mean,
it's kind of heavy-handed, but so is something that's coming up here. They get out onto the boat, and escape from everything. They're supposed to go to a buoy to meet this boat from the Human Project. And I kind of like that idea that like, that in order to start a new world, you have to become completely unmoored from the old one, you know, like if they're just, they're completely separate from it on this boat in the ocean. Theo, Theo's been shot and he finally succumbs to his wounds, right, is like, sees the boat that's supposed to meet them. And it's a beautiful scene, and Clive Owen does great there. And when the boat shows up, it's named Tomorrow, which is a little, you know, on the nose, but that's fine.
Well, they did reference it being called Tomorrow earlier in the film. Well, also, and there was a nice moment too, where she names the kid Dylan, and Clive Owen does a really good kind of, I'm content in my death thing. He's just, you know, he's got this kind of smirk. It's quite nice. And then
it's lovely.
The baby, I know, is a little too young to speak, but when the baby said Baba, and they're like, Bowie, Baba, Bowie, and then Clive Owen got back up and went, Howard Stern's penis. I thought that was a little obvious, but you know, it's fine.
It's good. I didn't like it as much when he sees the boat and the baby like lowers his sunglasses and goes, Daddy likey.
Yeah.
It's like, you're a baby, not a dad. Like, what?
I mean, I'm surprised they got Bruce Willis to do the voice, but I think it works. You know, you go with the best.
Yeah. I was surprised. I was like, look who's talking now.
Yeah.
But what I like is that, so that's the end of the movie, but like, in theory, it all went well. You know what I mean? In theory, that's what the boat was. And that's where they were going, but it's a bit ambiguous.
I also
I was going to say, because I mean, ultimately, it is really about Theo and his journey from apathy to actually doing something, which I think is one of the big messages of this movie. Is like you can't just, you know, you have to take note of this awful world around you and do something about it. But as far as like, you don't know what's necessarily going to happen in the future. You don't know that this could be like, yeah, we're actually a Russian cloning factory, and we're gonna make robots with baby brains. I don't know.
Or everybody on the ship is the witch from The Witch.
Right. Yeah. Like, we're eating tonight.
Oh boy, I'm so glad you guys finally picked me up. Wow, look at those well lubricated brooms you all have.
But yeah, no, I like that ambiguity about it.
Yeah, I was thinking what was interesting too is they don't mention it, you know, because the movie kind of ends at, you know, they point it out like it's the this is the beginning, the end of the beginning thing. But, you know, I wonder how many other people this happened to, but the baby didn't make it, you know, because the world's in shit.
Right.
So like how many other kind of almost versions of this movie happened, but like, you know, the other person in the key role died in a car accident or was like torn to death by fans or, you know what I'm saying?
Right. Or yeah. Just like impoverished to the point that, you know, they couldn't have a healthy pregnancy or.
Yeah. Or they're in the middle of nowhere that like there's a bunch of, you know, there's an 8-year-old in, you know, some mm-hmm. like really, really remote tribal area or, yeah. You know, just it's there's a lot of kind of not that I'm saying I want a sequel, but like it leaves a lot kind of meat on the bone that like it's not like, oh, hey, we just told the only story in this world. Like they told a story in this world, which is, I think, the more.
As I contend with any future dystopia, Mad Max is going on at the same time.
Yes.
And in fact, almost any movie you can shoot, Mad Max is going on at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, Mad Max basically is just Australia.
Crazy Rich Asians, same timeline as Mad Max.
I mean, I think it's pretty obvious. I mean, ultimately, like this is.
It's a little tough to watch in terms of like, you know, in 2006, although Alfonso Cuarón was like, I don't feel like much has changed. Like I made this movie in 2006 about like the stuff that was going on in 2006, but it certainly hits hard now. And I definitely recommend, if you like this, if you like his style at all, really check out Roma. It's unfortunate you can't see it in the theater, but because it was one of my favorite movies of last year. But it is a beautiful, beautiful movie.
Is that like the third Attack of the Killer Tomatoes?
It is. It is the third. The that's why it's the best one, because it has built on the first two. Did so much legwork. It's nice to see it come to fruition.
And finally, you can specify like these aren't like the beef tomatoes. These are Roma tomatoes. These are Roma,
yeah. And you tell that because they all wear little chef's hats.
Yes, the deadliest of tomatoes. Mm-hmm. So obviously, so we're talking about Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. Yeah, watch fucking Children of Men. The movie's good.
Yeah.
So John, for next episode, you know what I was thinking?
What were you thinking?
We should watch a movie with Madonna in it.
Oh yeah, because the Children of Men. Let's go with the Mother of Men, Savior, guy.
Well, no, I was thinking how the one thing in Children of Men, there's not a lot of really strict parenting, you know, because Papa don't preach.
Yes.
Does that work?
She was in trouble deep.
Because they were in the water. Got it. Yeah. Yep. Anyway, I don't remember much about the movie Dick Tracy.
Yeah, we're going to leave the gray, grimy end of mankind and go to colorful comic nonsense.
Yes.
From the early 90s with Warren Beatty. Madonna, Al Pacino's in, that's right. Al Pacino's in it.
Whoo! Yeah.
Comic book movies before comic book movies.
This will be pretty interesting, I think. So Dick Tracy, it's available all sorts of places. I just looked. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go do that.
He did his own detective work. We got a regular Dick Tracy here.
Oh, because he's a detective.
Yeah.
That's why he's called Dick. Mm-hmm. I thought he just outlined his cock.
Yeah.
Because well, Dick Tracy,
Yeah, that's kind of how he solves crimes. He kind of gets into a fugue state. We'll watch the movie.
Yeah, that knife looks like it's about 8 inches long. Wait, hold on a second, Johnny. Thwonk. Yep, two of my tiny penises.
Look, here's a drawing of a turkey I made you.
Can you guess what the waddle was? If you guess scrotum, okay, that's enough of that. Yeah, all right, so Dick Tracy, that'll be next time. Remember to do the things we tell you every time. No one ever does it, so I'm not going to bother to tell you what those are. All right, bye.
Bye-bye.